Coming up on this radio program today, in no particular order, the still sliding oil economy, live music as you run to catch that plane home for the holidays, and why, oh why, are politicians still stuck on television ads? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 8th day of December. This one is a Tuesday. Good to have you with us, everybody. You can take your oil prices two ways in this economy. You can use the global benchmark, what's called Brent North Sea Crude, which today dropped below $40 a barrel. Or you can use the U.S. Standard West Texas Intermediate, it's called. That dipped below $37 a whack. And those prices play out in a whole lot of ways. It plays out in what consumers are going to spend at the pump. It plays out in what it means for the strength or not strength of the global economy. And it plays out in what it means for the companies pulling all that oil out of the ground. American drillers have so far been resilient in the face of those low prices, so far being the operative phrase there. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
If you know the old cartoon, Wile E. Coyote runs off a cliff and then he suspends before he falls off. In the oil patch, Barbara Shook at Energy Intelligence Group says small independent drillers similarly can defy gravity no longer. Some three dozen have gone bankrupt.
They carry weaker balance sheets anyway, and they have less borrowing power. We've started seeing the smallest companies shutting the doors.
She likens this bust to 1986, when the Texas jobless rate went to 9%.
I think in the end it's going to be just as brutal as what we saw then.
Not everybody agrees. Ed Morse, head of commodities research at Citigroup, has long been bullish on U.S. producers, and he's long been right. But even Morse sees some pain ahead for the independents.
The indebtedness of these companies is going to really hit. They will run out of cash, many of them. They will not be able to drill. Production will go negative.
Next year, production will fall by almost 600,000 barrels a day, according to the U.S. government. The game now is which small drillers will go under first, says energy management professor Bill Arnold at Rice University. He cites a century-old comic strip, Alphonse and Gaston. Their shtick is over politeness. You go first. No, please. After you.
This has been something that's been going on for some months now. It's kind of I'd be happy to continue to produce, but I'd be even happier if you didn't.
Any shakeout should pull oil prices back up. The question for now is how long till that happens. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
As the company formerly known as Google reshapes itself into the company now known as Alphabet, we're getting a look inside some of the business units under that corporate umbrella. The division formerly known as Google Life Sciences got a new name this week. It's going to be called Verily, which is, in all honesty, a little Shakespearean for me, but whatever. It's basically Google's in-house private medical research company. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to make me smart on what it all means. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. This is just a name change, as I said. But Verily, the company that it is now called, what does it do? Why does it exist?
It exists to sort of get Google into the private medical research space. It was originally part of this life sciences division where Google was going to do science and medicine. And its first product was these contact lenses that could monitor glucose mm-hmm. levels in diabetics. Mm-hmm. That's actually going to be sold now through Novartis. Now it's going to focus on prevention, treatment, and big data, like machine learning, to sort of figure out if it can spot diseases and then treat them really on a personalized level.
All right, so here's what I want to know, and not to take anything away from the mission here, but why is Google in the medical and the life sciences business to begin with?
Yeah, you know, some of it is the ideals of the founders. All these tech guys, all these tech entrepreneurs want to change the world, and medicine and healthcare is sort of the easiest way. But it's also a huge business, right? Yeah. I mean, these guys are looking into sequencing the genome and figuring out how to research DNA to the extent that they could sell massive stores of data to pharmaceutical companies. They can license the research to institutions and private companies. They could cure cancer and make a ton of money on that. So as with most things, it's kind of half ideal yeah. and half, you know, money making.
Well, so and as with most things, Google, part of it is a little moonshot, right? And you get that because that's sort of the DNA of that company. But are they going to make money with Verily?
Well, you know, the good news for us, at least the viewers, the watchers at home, is that Alphabet, which is, you know, Verily's part of Alphabet, is a public company. So we get to find out if these divisions make money. And the assumption is that they will. I mean, certainly the contact lenses are a viable product. They're working on wearables, the type of wearables that could detect cancer. And so if really effective research comes out of this, I think every one of their moonshots is the hope that, you know, there's a 10% chance that it will become 90% of the business.
That's a good line. So sidestep this for a second, though, and talk to me about this general issue of privatizing healthcare research, right? It's not like Google's the only one who's doing it, but because they're Google, we're paying attention to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've seen Apple, Microsoft, Google, all of them really get into medical research, into the healthcare field in some way. So it's kind of a thing, but it happens to go hand in hand with the fact that the U.S. has been cutting medical research funding for about the last 10 years. And that directly affects early stage research and treatment and prevention discovery. So the kinds of things that you're seeing these private companies involved in now. The concern, of course, is that the funding can be influenced by the agenda of the billionaire or the company. But I think you would find scientists who said that was the case with public funding, too.
Yeah, but also market forces, right? Because I was about to say it's part of Google. It's Verily is part of Alphabet, technically Google, right? So it's a publicly traded enterprise, and it has to respond to the markets.
It does, exactly. And again, that has been an argument with public science funding as well, that, for example, Big Pharma might have had a hand in driving some medical research, some disease research. Right now, there's no studies. There's no real way to gauge the impact of this kind of privatization, but there's no question it's a trend. And Verily is kind of just the latest incarnation. A pretty ambitious one, I will say.
Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
On Wall Street today could have been worse. And yes, I know that is 2 days in a row that I've said that. I report, you decide. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to talk in a bit about how retail advertising is changing, but a whole lot of advertising is pretty resolutely stuck in the past. Billions of dollars are going to be spent this election cycle by candidates at all levels, national, state, and local, on ads that are going to run on boring, plain old TV. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer went in search of the reason why.
So if you're running for office, you tend to do what your consultants tell you to do. And consultants like TV. It's safe. In many cases, it's what they've always done. And then there's the money.
Consultants may have an incentive to sell TV to their candidates.
That's Adam Scheingate. He teaches political science at Johns Hopkins University. He decided to look into why we're still seeing so many campaign ads on TV. His conclusion?
It's the most lucrative part of the business from the consultant's perspective. It provides the greatest opportunity to make money.
Here's how it works. A political candidate hires a consultant. The consultant says, let's blanket the airwaves. The candidate says, okay. The consultant places the ads with TV stations and takes a commission, 10, 15% of the cost of the ad. Scheingate says, that adds up.
If the ad buy was $1 million ad buy, then you might be receiving a commission of $100,000 or $150,000 for that ad buy.
I wanted to run this theory by a consultant. I found Angela McCann. She's chief operating officer for Mentzer Media Services, a Republican consulting firm in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. I head out there.
Hi, you Angela?
Yes.
Hey.
Nice to meet you.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
I asked McCann, does her company tell candidates to buy TV ads because it'll get a commission? She says, no way.
Our goal is that our clients are successful, not that we're just successful.
McCann says if she were just focused on getting as much money from TV ads as she could, she wouldn't be winning many campaigns and would go out of business.
We wouldn't be buying media for anyone anymore if we weren't winning.
McCann says she tells candidates to advertise on TV because it's still the best way to reach a mass audience. And the voters who actually show up at the polls tend to be older. They still watch TV. She says sometimes the candidates themselves are older and are pushing for TV ads. You can see that in the numbers. Elizabeth Wilner tracks political advertising for Kantar Media.
So we've seen about
roughly 7 times more TV spots in the presidential race than we had seen at this time 4 years ago. That means individual occurrences of television ads.
Wellner doesn't expect the TV advertising to let up, leading her to this conclusion.
TV will still be king in 2016.
And that is something Adam Scheingate and Angela McCann actually agree on. They both say TV is at the top and unlikely to be dethroned anytime soon. They just disagree on why. So get ready for more TV ads, especially from the big spenders like Hillary Clinton.
So that every child has a chance to live up to his or her God-given potential.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
And Jeb Bush.
I've delivered, and I hope to earn your support. I'm Jeb Bush, and I approve this message.
Of course, if you don't like all these TV messages, you could just turn off the TV. Just saying. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Colombian government says it's found a 300-year-old shipwreck off its coast with what educated guesses figure is about $17 billion in treasure aboard. The wreck also obviously has serious historical value, but neither the treasure nor the history have been lost on various interested parties, all of whom want to share in the bounty. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, when it comes to sea and sunken treasure, finders aren't always keepers.
One evening in late spring 1708, off the coast of what's now Cartagena, the San Jose was carrying 600 people and more in emeralds, gold, and silver than the entire national income of Spain at the time.
Billions of dollars in today's money.
That's Ted Folkman, an attorney with Murphy King, who's written about this. The treasure was bound to help France fight the British in the War of Spanish Succession, but a British squadron got to it first and unleashed a hail of cannon fire. According to one account, there was so much blood on the deck that sand was put down to keep people from slipping. Just after sunset, the ship went down with almost everyone and everything aboard.
People have been looking for it ever since.
An American firm, Sea Search Armada, says it found a likely location back in 1981. At the time, it had an agreement to split the value of the treasure 50-50 with the government of Colombia. Then, Colombia passed a law changing that to 5%. The company says that fight is ongoing. Meanwhile, Spain also has a claim to the treasure.
The legalities of shipwrecks has been an issue for hundreds of years.
Frederick Hanselman is underwater archaeologist at Texas State University. Not only are laws different in every country and every state, the facts are often murky.
So if you have a Spanish ship that sank in Mexican waters carrying gold and silver mined in modern-day Peru, who owns it?
Courts in different places have divvied up treasure in many different ways.
I don't like the term treasure.
Professor Mariano Aznar is professor of law at University of Jaume in Spain. He has words for people who get too enchanted by riches.
It reduces the wreck to a monetary value. We are talking about heritage.
In the case of the San Jose, it's also the gravesite of 600 people. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Music isn't like making pencils. If you make a bad pencil, it's like, okay, you can just throw it away. But a song, you know, this is where you put your heart into.
Your holiday entertainment now boarding at gate C41. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 162 points today. That's 0.9% on the blue chips, closed at 17,568. The NASDAQ down 3 points, less than 0.1%, 5,098. The S&P 500 off 13 points, 0.6%, 2,063. As oil prices trickled to that 7-year low I mentioned, energy companies followed them down. ExxonMobil dipped 2.8%. Energy infrastructure firm Kinder Morgan gave up 4.2% today. London-based Anglo American lost 12.3%. Wait till you hear why. The mining giant announced it's laying off 60% of its workforce, 60%, 85,000 people. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Think about the last time you walked by a construction site, all right? Do you see many tradeswomen there, female carpenters or electricians or plumbers? Yeah, it's a trick question because there just aren't many of them. The construction gender gap has been around for decades, even though those jobs can pay up to $50 an hour and don't require a college degree. So now there is a big push to get more women interested in the construction trades. From Youth Radio, Casey Saturn reports.
Construction is booming, but women are hardly in the picture. Only 2.6% of the field. So what's a quick way to gather some girl recruits? Hold a career fair. This is the Women Can Build Career Fair in Hayward, California. Here, even as a reporter, people were trying to recruit me. And I did get my hands dirty at Bob Noto's booth, working with plaster.
Am I doing this right?
Yeah, just maybe put a little more pressure.
Okay, this isn't, it's like painting. I've never done this before.
Standing there with a trowel in my hand, I have to admit, I had fun. So did Jocelyn Cruz.
I just cut a piece of steel with fire and oxygen.
Cruz is 17 years old. She's here at the fair with a bunch of her classmates from Mount Diablo High School. Savannah Isasi is one of them.
My dad does plumbing, and he's like always telling me about his job.
So if she gets into the trade, she knows what to expect. I asked her what she thinks the biggest challenge might be, based on what she hears from her dad.
Probably men would be the biggest obstacle because they're, you know, they're stronger and they get more opportunities in these type of jobs than women do.
Another issue is sexual harassment, something the Department of Labor says 88% of women in the field experience at some point. Just ask Angela Molina, who I found at the sheet metal booth. She's been a sheet metal worker for 30 years and something of a pioneer.
I had to endure a lot. Back then, women aren't typically seen on a job site. So it's like, what do I do about this? I had no one to talk to. I really didn't have any example to follow. So I just kept it in.
Molina says the field is better than it used to be, but it's still not great. That didn't stop Natasha Pineda from diving in. She went from a job in retail to working in building maintenance. And she found herself making way more money.
I was making over 80 grand a year. You're like, wait, I'm not even finished with my apprenticeship yet. It's definitely a lucrative field.
Pineda will graduate from her apprenticeship next year and be fully certified. So yeah, she's making 80 grand while she's still taking classes. And she graduates with no debt. To 16-year-old Savannah Isasi, that's one reason to consider going into construction, despite the obvious challenges.
There's not really a lot of opportunities for women to be able to do all of these types of jobs that are really great for our community.
So after a few hours testing out different construction tools, Isasi and the other teen girls left the fair with one more job possibility in mind. In Hayward, California, I'm Casey Saturn for Marketplace.
Casey's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. In the land of consumer news, there is this today. Procter & Gamble, the consumer products behemoth, is moving a big chunk of its advertising budget to a new company, Omnicom. P&G owns classic brands like Crest and Charmin and Bounty, as you might know. It also is among the world's biggest advertisers. Last year, it spent more than $2.5 billion on ads. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more now on what P&G's move says about the ad industry writ large.
More than $30 billion of media spending could be in play this year. Bottom line, companies want to reduce costs. Andrea Marterkick is with Media Associates. The company buys and sells ads. She says as digital advertising explodes, data is the new currency in the advertising world.
The new hot departments at every agency now are the analytic departments.
The departments which are sifting through data, like your Google searches and Facebook posts, trying to figure out what you want to buy and where it's best to sell it to you.
It's great if you have a lot of data, but if you don't know how to use the data or how to interpret the data, it just becomes a data dump.
That's why more agencies are depending on computers and advertising technology to make ad buys. You could call all these changes to advertising a bit of an upheaval, but Marterkick works in the industry, so she puts a different spin on things.
I wouldn't call it an upheaval. I would call it a transformation.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
you're going to be flying to wherever you're going over the holidays, there is a decent chance you're going to be making a stop in Atlanta. Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, as it's officially known, handles more passengers than any other airport on the planet, some not insignificant slice of them, this time of year, which can be, as we all know, miserable. So the airport is bringing in some local musicians to play travelers' stresses away. Jim Burris from WABE in Atlanta takes us to auditions.
Retired firefighter Tavius Elder has played countless bookings since he began strumming a guitar at age 6. But the 54-year-old has a lot riding on these next few minutes.
Sometimes it gets tough around this time of year. After the fall, around Thanksgiving, the work slows down.
Elder says seasonal work lets him catch up on bills, help his family out, which is why he put on a suit and showed up here at the Georgia International Convention Center to audition.
Mr. Zach Contavious, my name is Steve Mayers. You have up to 5 minutes to perform. Begin.
With acoustic guitar in hand and saxophonist Zach Grady handling the melody, the audition seems to go as smoothly as the tones coming from the duo's instruments.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. That's very good.
Thank you.
Make sure that
they don't get an offer. Tavius Elder says if nothing else comes through,
I'll play on the corner. I mean, I'll go back to that. There is a limit, but the street corner, I find that works, and I can go out and make 20, 50 bucks a day, ass up at the end of the week.
But I think that we all depend as freelance musicians on the holiday season income.
That's Ray Hare. He's the international president of the 80,000-member American Federation of Musicians. He says on average, freelance musicians should expect 20, maybe 30% of their income to roll in between Thanksgiving and New Year's.
I don't know if it's make or break. I do know that freelancers depend on the holidays to put bread on the table and catch up.
So how much bread can the musicians hired put on their tables this season? Hard to say, says Hartsfield-Jackson International's Director of Guest Relations, Steve Mayers.
We're going to have an open bid process where we invite those 35 to bid on the per-hour charge.
Mayers has a budget of 25 grand. Divvying that up, though, is kind of complex. Performers submit a bid for what they think they should earn. A computer then crunches those bids and, voila, spits out a figure. Mayers estimates musicians will earn anywhere from $50 to $150 an hour. Back at the auditions, those waiting to try out have no idea what the gig pays. Jeremiah Turner and Kevin Grayson don't seem too caught up on it, though. Grayson says it's not always about the dollars. Sometimes it's about the numbers.
Atlanta's airport is the busiest in the world. So with the traffic and the volume of people that come through, our music is exposed to everybody.
Thank you very much for coming in today. You have up to 5 minutes to perform.
They call themselves Unknown Lyric. Afterward, they feel confident. Guitarist Jeremiah Turner.
You know, it's always cool at the end of these when you feel like they like your music, because music isn't like making pencils. If you make a bad pencil, it's like, okay, you can just throw it away. But a song, you know, this is where you put your heart into. So anytime you can be accepted and liked for what you do and who you are, you know, it's always an extra smile to your day.
No surprise, they get an offer. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I'll be completely honest with you here, you guys, I don't fully understand. I saw on Quartz this morning that the U.S. Postal Service is testing a new product. It's going to send you an email with a picture of the envelopes of your letters. Think about that for a minute. We've known for a couple of years now that the USPS is photographing every letter and package it handles. It helps in sorting the mail, apparently, and in law enforcement as well, which is great. But what am I going to do with a picture of an envelope that I'm going to get in the mail in a couple of days? Seriously. Well, that was awkward. All right, the Dow off 162 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 3 points, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 off 13 points, about 0.6%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.